This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economic Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Hello, my name's Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 25th of February 2009, our guest speaker was Brendan Sheehan of Leeds Metropolitan University, speaking on the theme, The General Theory and Policies for Global Prosperity. His talk was based partly on his book, Understanding Keynes' General Theory. And you can download a PowerPoint presentation to go with the talk from the Keynes Seminar page on the PKSG website. Enjoy listening.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. And thank you for attending tonight's seminar. I'm very grateful that you could take the time this evening to come along and listen, hopefully, to some sagacious points, which I might or might not make in the next 50 minutes. Mark did note that I'd started writing in 1988. However, there was a long interregnum while I was beginning to work out that something wasn't right. What I'd been taught, what I'd read in the textbooks, was not in alignment with what I'd read in the general theory. And I have to thank Jeff, because he taught a course then. It wasn't none of these modules then, they were courses, with Bob Rowthorne, Robert Rowthorne, as he is now. And I decided, youthful precocity, to try and look at the treatise on money and see if I could make a relationship with the monetary theory to the general theory itself. And I was even more convinced, having done an extended essay, that something was wrong. And I was thinking how I began to realise that there was a difference between what I was reading in the textbooks and what Keynes was saying. And I used to go round to my peers at the time saying, but what is the rate of interest? What is the rate of interest? What economic function does it perform? Is it a reward for waiting? An abstinence? And that was, it just didn't strike me as correct. And when I looked at liquidity preference, that wasn't the message I was getting from Keynes. And then you would look at various other interpreters, and they would say, actually, one's short run, one's long run. There's actually no great difference between them. I think in Keynes's famous Fundamental Ideas article, Quarterly Journal of Economics, 1937, which is in volume 14 of the collected writings, he actually mentions an economist who'd said, you know, basically your theory's pretty much the same as the accepted theory. I think it's Pigou. The accepted theory of loanable funds. And Keynes says, well, sorry, I don't think that's correct. Once I'd worked out that liquidity preference was different, then I moved on to the multiplier. And for this, I had John Eatwell to thank in his course, because it forced me to concede that this ability of the multiplier to equalise investment and savings meant that the loanable funds market wasn't necessary, because that's what the loanable funds market in the classical theory is supposed to do. And as you can see, bit by bit, I put the jigsaw together, and the jigsaw came out completely different from the one I'd been told it should be. And once I got the theory correct in my mind, then the policy implications, because the reason why John Maynard Keynes writes the general theory is to justify the policies which he'd already argued for in the early 1930s. This is the irony. He'd already come almost intuitively to the ideas in terms of policy recommendations, and then he had to work backwards to develop the theoretical framework. The treatise on money was an effort, an attempt, ultimately a failed attempt, to provide that coherent theoretical justification. The general theory is the seminal work. Keynes is happier, not completely happy, happier with the general theory than any other previous work. And if he hadn't had the debilitating heart attack in 1937, he probably would have written the second edition and refined it. We had to wait for a later version of the second edition of the general theory. So what was the leitmotiv of his policy proposals? Well, in essence, it was a preference for expansionary cures over contractionary cures. And a contractionary cure, if one thinks about it, is to cut wages. If there is a limitation of demand, the contractionist cure is to lower wages, pull prices down, and almost, it's like a real balance effect, generate the additional aggregate demand to stimulate the economy. And Keynes has many objections, social, political, intuitive objections. By the time he gets onto the general theory, he's got a theoretical objection. And perhaps most contentious in this book is the idea that Keynes, for all intents and purposes, puts to one side the aggregated labour market. And by the aggregated labour market, I mean a labour market derived from aggregating up all the microeconomic sectoral labour markets into an aggregated labour market, forgetting the ceteris paribus assumption that on individual labour markets, the level of aggregate effective demand can be held constant. Once you aggregate all those individual labour markets up into a full-scale aggregate demand for labour, aggregate supply of labour related to the real wage, actually, it doesn't quite make sense if the level of aggregate effective demand varies. And in fact, if one thinks about it, with effective demand, theory of aggregate effective demand, what did Keynes call it? The theory of the demand and supply for output as a whole. You don't actually need an aggregated labour market. You've already determined the level of employment. So you dispense with it. You push it to one side. Now, what I've done, and I'll come on to it. So that's the cure for a global depression. And I'll quickly review his ideas in terms of the implications of an international wage cut to counter a global depression. An international wage cut was something Keynes particularly despised because he thought it might have very serious repercussions for dragging the global economy into a massive downturn. And then the second exemplar I use in the paper is, all right, by the latter part of World War II, he's beginning to look at the post-war world. How do we ensure that this never happens again? Each individual nation should pursue expansionary fiscal and monetary policies to maintain full employment. But will the trade balances between nations allow that to be sustained? Will trade imbalances, deficits and surpluses, get so out of alignment that actually undermines the whole expansionary cure? And hence Keynes, as we'll see, using the analogy of banking principles from a closed economy, develops a new idea, the second Keynes plan, to create a global trading and commercial system. And I want to finish on that because some international leaders are coming to this country in April, the G20, and I thought, you know, it might not be a bad idea to throw this into the melting pot to discuss these issues. So, what is the theoretical justification? Now, this is a very quick summary of 320 pages. But in essence, let's... people say to me when I've taught them, what should I read to understand the general theory? This is my insight. Take it or leave it. For what it's worth, this is my insight. Read chapter 18. Read chapter 18. It's a very good summary. And then read, as I mentioned earlier on, the general theory, fundamental concepts and ideas, the Quarterly Journal of Economics article, 1937, where Keynes, having listened to a great number of criticisms, Leontief, Pigou, and the rest, says, all right, I've taken that on board, let me restate it. And I think the purity of the message in those two pieces of work, you should keep those in your mind when you're reading the rest of the book, because sometimes it gets a little bit hairy at points. But if you hold on to chapter 18 and that Quarterly Journal of Economics article, you won't actually go too far wrong. What does he do in chapter 18? He outlines what he calls the ultimate independent variables. I've added one, but that's by the by. The propensity to consume. Now, people think about the propensity to consume. Why is that radical? Ladies and gentlemen, if you accept Say's law, saving determines investment and saving determines consumption. You can't get away from it. It's what's left out of income. Once you break with Say's law, you've got a problem. How do you explain consumption? And what Keynes does is he explains it in one equation. Now that's genius for you. And the propensity to consume, developed in partnership with Richard Kahn. A fundamental psychological law of economics, he calls it. Once you've got the propensity to consume, what else have you got? The multiplier. Without breaking with Say's law, you can't get there. Which is why 150 years of economists prior to Keynes hadn't identified that relationship. What about investment? You put to one side the loanable funds market. How are you going to explain investment? Firstly, from the firm's point of view, entrepreneurs, as he refers to them, the psychological expectations of the future yields on capital assets. And that could be over 10, 20, 30, 50 years. If you're looking at a building, remember the Empire State Building was, finished in 1932? Until after Second World War, it was known in New York as the empty state building because they couldn't fill it. How do you derive expectations over long periods of time? Clearly, the foundation for making those expectations is flimsy, to say the least. And the state of liquidity preference. This is from the wealth holder's point of view. If you think about it, we're looking to place assets in different or resources in different assets. How do we decide at what rate of interest we're prepared to forego our liquidity? Now, the aggregate supply relationship, oh dear. This is the relationship between the aggregate supply price, which is the revenues that entrepreneurs expect that will just induce them to provide a volume of employment. And we'll keep that steady. Then the last variable that we can take into account is the wage unit. And Keynes, unlike most of the Keynesian mainstream, allows the wage unit to vary. And then he considers the implications of varying the wage unit on the propensity to consume, the marginal efficiency of capital, which is derived from the psychological expectations of the future yields on capital assets, and the state of liquidity preference. The one thing which is worth mentioning is the long-term state of expectation. It's something which has caused confusion even in the most eminent of subsequent Keynesian writers. Short-term expectations, long-term expectations. Clearly, state of long-term expectations will influence prospective yields, what entrepreneurs think they will generate in terms of profits from investing in capital assets. Clearly, the state of long-term expectations will influence a wealth holder's decisions whether they put their resources in a long-term bond or in liquid cash. So how does Keynes make the link between the short-term and the long-term? He focuses on short-period changes in the state of long-term expectations. That state of expectation is based on flimsy foundations, and it can fluctuate in the short term. In fact, it's likely to fluctuate in the short run. And that, aligned with the conventional method of calculation, we assume the future to be the present to be a serviceable guide to the future. We assume that prices and outputs in stock markets and various places are correct. And the third convention, when all else fails, we just believe what everybody else believes. This is an inherently unstable method of calculation. And yet, what else is available? With an unstable conventional method of calculation and short period fluctuations in the state of long-term expectation, you explain unstable investment spending, private investment spending. So let's just summarise that. Aggregate effective demand is the summation of expected consumption spending measured in aggregate consumption spending measured in wage units and investment spending measured in wage units, and that derives for you the level of the aggregate demand price. The actually expected revenues from the sale of output associated with the volume of employment. So the aggregate demand price is what you actually expect to generate. The aggregate supply price, which is ZW, is what would just induce you to provide that employment. Very Marshallian in that sense. And the two are not necessarily equal. But where they are equal, the level of effective demand or aggregate effective demand is derived. And here is the crucial point. Aggregate effective demand determines the volume of aggregate employment, not a labour market. It helps to determine the price level, the general price level. And because you've already defined your wage unit, the money wage, deflated by the price level, you've derived the real wage. Ladies and gentlemen, if the real wage is a dependent variable in Keynes's model, the aggregated labour market cannot stand. Cannot stand. And yet that is Keynes's theory, very clearly. So what is the cause of unemployment, or indeed inflation? Keynes's theory is not just restricted to the economics depression, as Hicks would suggest. It's a general theory. It applies to all states, or theoretically, unemployment, full employment, inflationary periods. Well, the cause, of course, is unstable aggregate effective demand. And once again, I would suggest that you turn to chapter 18, where towards the end of chapter 18, Keynes gives an extended discussion on the subject of what he calls certain psychological propensities. And those psychological propensities are a good old Marshallian economist saying, basically, this is how you develop an unemployment equilibrium. He doesn't work it through properly, and he mentions the unemployment equilibrium in another part of the book. But clearly, he's suggesting, look, the economy isn't rapidly unstable. It doesn't move from zero employment to full employment and back again. There are these propensities which keep it within certain bounds. So, well, you can read the book and make up your own, reach your own opinion on whether I've convinced you or not. But that's my opinion for what it's worth. Anyway, let's use the theory. Let's use the theory. The contractionist cure. Let's say there's a global depression. When does that happen recently? Let's say that you go for international wage cutting. Now, I will just make a point in passing how absent from the policy debate in this particular economic downturn has been the idea of cutting wages. And perhaps people might want to ask me my profundities as to why that is the case after I've finished the lecture. But I think it's very interesting. But in the 1930s, when Keynes was writing on the Macmillan Report, in fact, he wrote quite a lot of the Macmillan Report himself, they actually considered wage cuts of 30% in Britain. In fact, in Mussolini, in Italy, I think in 1928, cut wages overnight by 20%. That's one way of doing it, called fascism.
So it's half-fascism.
Half-fascism. Well, ironically enough, Keynes thinks that's the situation which is most likely to generate higher employment, which means that the classical theory justifies fascist policies. Something I don't think some of the classical economists took particularly kindly to, but there we go. Such is life. What would be the impact on aggregate effective demand? Well, in terms of the propensity to consume, probably disadvantageous. In terms of the marginal efficiency of the rate and the rate of interest, it could go either way. In terms of debt burdens and confidence, well, you know. And I think in a 1939 article, which is an appendix to the general theory itself, response to Dunlop and Tarshish, is it? Keynes says, well, you know, in chapter 19, I went through this, and it's very hard to generalise about what the effect a general cut in money wages would be on a particular economy. It could go either way. In fact, even more reason not to take that chance and to pursue a far more likely option of the expansionary cure. But could it work? Actually, Keynes says the most likely situation in which it could work for a national economy is if one nation cut its wages, and then it would get the benefit of the balance of trade. Effectively, it would be taking demand away from its neighbours. It's a form of beggar thy neighbour policy, but it could work. The problem, what if other countries impose tariffs on your goods? Because you're effectively trying to compete your way out of a depression at their expense. Then the beneficial effect would be countered. So he's not very convinced about that. He allows it a possibility of a competitive wage cut influencing one economy in a beneficial way. What about if everybody cut their wages? Because that's really what the classical theory would suppose. Unemployment is an excess supply of labour. On the labour market, the real wage is too high. The money wage is too high. Cut wages. Now, where does Keynes see the great problem of that? Well, what had caused the Great Depression? A major financial meltdown. A bank in Austria went bankrupt, and it had repercussions around the world. That, once again, that sounds quite familiar, doesn't it? And Keynes said, well, we want to cut wages and prices. What does that do? That increases debt burdens, the real value of debt burdens. Do we really want to go back to that situation? That could lead to catastrophe. So Keynes, having been an opponent of wage cutting since the 1920s with Mr. Churchill's return to the gold standard, he retains that consistency all the way through, and he says, please do not go for international wage cuts. That is the worst of the worst options. The only consequence that will emerge out of trying to cut wages in that way is lower aggregate effective demand and higher worldwide unemployment. And thankfully, in this global economic downturn, nobody's gone for that particular option. And you might want to reflect upon why that might be the case. But what I want to turn to, as I say, because we're going to be debating these things, it's one thing to get yourself out of a depression. But how do you make sure that you try and avoid that eventuality reoccurring? Now, in... I've gone slightly ahead of myself. Global depression, the expansionary cure. What do you need? Globally coordinated fiscal expansion. What should lead that? A state-led program of capital development. Not policies to stimulate the propensity to consume, Not policies to make bank lending easier to consumers. That's a very 21st century solution. Coordinated with cheap money, expansionary monetary policy. The advantage of that, it would help promote private investment spending. Now, that would stimulate aggregate effective demand and worldwide employment, but something else. Because as the economy expands, as employment expands, something else increases. The price level. The general price level increases. And what Keynes calls semi-inflation. One of those things you come across in the general theories, and he has a distinction between semi-inflation and true inflation. You don't think, that's really interesting, that. What's semi-inflation? Semi-inflation occurs when nominal aggregate effective demand increases. And part of that increase is made up of higher output and employment, and part of it is made up of increases in prices. But the increase in prices is less than the increase in nominal effective demand. What's the other concept? True inflation. True inflation occurs at full employment. Then you increase nominal effective demand, perhaps through an increase in the money supply, a la our friend Milton Friedman, and you get the quantity theory of money. No problem, because that's what the classical theory basically assumes, full employment. And I was communicating with a guy from Holland, Utrecht University, and he said, well, I'm really worried about this quantitative easing, this increasing in the money supply. We did it in the 1970s, and it led to very high rates of inflation. And I replied, I said, well, this is not the 1970s. This is not the 1970s. We're in a different situation. Stop fighting your last battle. Fight the battle that you're in at the moment. So semi-inflation actually lowers global debt burden. It gives an advantage to the entrepreneur who takes the risk, to the disadvantage of the rentier who just sits there placing their resources in various assets. Surely we should give advantage, if any advantage is to be given, to the entrepreneur, the one who, as Schumpeter said, the perennial gale of capitalism, that's what it's all about. We've got out of the Great Depression. World War II has shown, is a little laboratory test. If you stimulate effective demand, what happens to employment? It rises. All those shipbuilding workers up in the northeast of England who'd been unemployed. Why? Because international trade had collapsed and you don't need ships to move goods and services around the world if you're in a global depression. If you don't need ships, you don't need shipbuilders. Oh, well, real wages are too high. Money wages are too high. They're rigid. Why don't we just increase the demand for ships? Hitler comes along. Japanese come along. Yada, yada, yada. Solved. We move from a position in 1940, Dunkirk, in Britain. 10% of the workforce was still unemployed in Britain. By 1942, there's a labour famine. 2 years. Real wages too high? Money wages too high? So, you get out of the Great Depression, the World War II sets you up for a new period of Keynesian expansion. What's the problem? Let's say that in this new era, every nation is committed to full employment. Every nation is prepared to pursue expansionary fiscal and monetary policies. The problem is trade imbalances. What if America starts to get very heavy deficits and Japan and France and Germany start to get very heavy surpluses? What happens then? Well, if you're in a fixed exchange rate system, as we'll see, like the gold standard, oh dear. Well, let's have a look. What did happen to the gold standard? The interwar gold standard. I think it's fair to say that Keynes thinks that prior to World War I, the gold standard worked in a completely different way to that to the way it worked in the interwar period. And in the interwar period, when there were significant trade imbalances, as was inevitable given the dislocation of World War I, The gold standard suggested asymmetric adjustment. One deliberate mistake, as I'm sure you're going to mention, that shouldn't say detonation, that should say deficit nation. And what happens with a deficit nation? How do you get rid of your trade deficit? Raise interest rates, deflate your economy, stop your imports coming in. But your imports are somebody else's exports. We're in a global economy, we're all in it together. And ironically, as you reduce your trade deficits, the surpluses of the powerful nations also shrink. You get, you know, broad alignment of trade balances, but at an awful lot lower level of economic activity, higher unemployment. And in that famous phrase that Keynes used when he's talking about the international clearing union, he says, in the interwar period, we all marched backwards together. And that's the contractionist cure. You deflate, you reduce, you constrain, and you hope that somehow, through some form of osmosis, demand will pick up. What then is the solution? And this, as I say, Keynes goes away for about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months and thinks about it. Because it's clear the Americans want to discuss the arrangements for the post-war world. And the Treasury sends Keynes away to think about it. And I've got to say, what he comes back with, it's an act of genius. I just would never have thought of it. I remember reading it and thinking, I would have never put these two ideas together in a million years. What he does is he looks at the banking principles of a closed economy. And what he realises is in banking principle, what is a banking principle? Perhaps we should remind people what banking sound banking principles are. Why did banks emerge? Well, you know, people would have metallic currency, gold, silver, bronze, and they put it in the bank and they put it in the vault, lock it in. That's what a bank vault was. And then the banks start to think, hold on, they don't come back for much of this money. Perhaps we could start lend that money out to make some profit out. And ironically, in medieval times, in the mercantilist writings, the great fear is hoarding. Hoarding. And when you look from our perspective, what's the problem? Because, and of course, banks are the solution to hoarding because you can hoard your money. You put it in the bank, it's a bank deposit. But then they take your money, what, 95, 97% of it, and lend it out to people who actually want it because their demand for money exceeds their resources. The problem of hoarding is eliminated. And is that the way in which we pump prime economic development? Without such practices by the banks, would we have had capitalism starting in 1750 in England? So what he does is he says, what do banks do? They create an elastic supply of bank money. And that supply, that money supply, fluctuates in response to economic activity. And the other beauty of it is, in the banking system, the liabilities and the assets cancel each other out. They're balanced. And all he says is, let's apply that to a global system. So I think, I would have never made that connection. It's obvious. People say, oh, it's obvious. No, it isn't obvious. It's obvious once somebody's told you. And he creates this idea in the treaties. He talked about a supranational bank, I think. And he talked about an international price level, the international standard. But he's still trying to make the gold standard work. He'd realised the gold standard had to go, so he had to create something to replace it. And this international clearing bank would create an elastic supply of international money, which he calls Bancor. But interestingly, in a briefing note to British ambassadors around the world who had to go to different governments to persuade them of this brilliant British idea, he says, if any of you ambassadors can think of a better name for it, I'd be quite happy to use it. He obviously wasn't particularly happy with Bancor, but We've got it. It's called Bancorp. And what's interesting about this elastic supply of international money, it, as we will see, it allows us to overcome the hoarding of trade surpluses. Just like banks overcome the hoarding of metallic currency. Now, what's required is this ICU, the International Clearing Union, only deals with central banks. As I'll come back to this point. It is a genuinely radical point, which if only the G20 leaders who were going to meet here in April would take fully into account, we might actually get somewhere. And it's a fixed exchange rate regime, and national currencies are fixed in terms of Bancor terms. What's Bancor valued in terms of? It's valued in terms of gold, an ounce of gold. Now, Ernie Bevin was the Labour Secretary in the War Coalition Government, then became the Foreign Secretary. When he was in the War Coalition Government, he sees this and thinks, aha, we're going back to the gold standard, and Keynes has to go and visit him in Whitehall and say, no, this is just camouflage. I'm getting rid of the gold standard. It's Bancor which is important. Gold is just an emotive, a subjective symbol that people feel confident with, and we'll pretend that there's some objective value associated with it. So how does it work? So here's the expansionary cure to trade imbalances. Trade deficit nation has a debit count with the ICU. The trade surplus nation has a credit count with the ICU. As far as the ICU is concerned, liabilities and assets equal. No problem. Just a banking principle, an accounting principle. Really. Now, the problem is, what happens when certain countries run very heavy trade deficits and other countries run very heavy trade surpluses? This is the problem of the interwar gold standard. The ICU must get both nations, both categories of nations, to respond. And it's related to what Keynes calls trigger points, which is it's in the paper, it's a technicality. Interestingly enough, the trigger points for deficit nations are more onerous than the trigger points for surplus nations. But as Keynes says, that's because we're frightened of the surplus nations. They're more powerful than the deficit nations, so we'll give them that little point there. And what you get is symmetrical adjustment. Now, why is symmetrical adjustment so important? Because if you have a trade surplus, you've got to spend that surplus on what? Imports. Or capital exports to the rest of the world. And that generates additional economic activity. Economic activity is increased, employment is increased, and we resolve trade imbalances not by lowering economic activity, by increasing economic activity. Of course, quite a lot of Keynes's fellow economists in the Treasury at the time thought, well, this could be inflationary. And Keynes had to fight those opponents off. He had to amend his proposals in the end. It's quite interesting. I think it's one of the later volumes, I'm sure Mark will tell me, 24, 25, the International Clearing Union. And there's the different versions of the paper. The first paper is pure. That's Keynes. I've gone away. I've been on my farm. I've thought about it. Here's an economist's take. And then by the fourth or fifth draft, and it's gone off to the Americans and come back, the purity is lost, but the essence is still there. It's the expansionary cure. As Keynes says, marching forward together. And I think that's why I try to get over to students when I teach new students who've never done economics before, business students, international students. And I say, what you've got to work out with globalisation, you've come from Brazil and India and China and Taiwan and Vietnam. You're now part of global capitalism. And with global capitalism, we either all sink or swim together. isn't it Benjamin Franklin said when they signed when he signed the Declaration of Independence, we have to hang together or we'll hang separately. We've got to hang together. And to be fair to our Prime Minister Gordon Brown, he has been aware of the dangers of protectionism, which is another form of contractionist cure. Now let's look at some of the consequences. Some of the consequences are quite profound, not just in economics, but in politics. Political economy, if I'm allowed to use that phrase here at Cambridge. Central banks monopolise currency dealings on behalf of their citizens. No foreign exchange market. That global market, was it $2 trillion of transactions every day? Is it in the public good? Yes, it makes certain people very wealthy, George Soros, but is it to the advantage of the many or the few? And when your central bank grants licenses to access foreign currency, who does it give priority to? Those who export and those who invest, direct invest abroad. Because both of those activities are trying to engender economic activity and employment. When the currency speculator comes, what happens? You don't get the license. And although Keynes didn't use that phrase, he did use this phrase in another setting, the euthanasia of the rentier. If you eliminate the habitat of the currency speculator, they will go off and make money somewhere else. They won't be poor. These people are extremely bright. If they can't make money out of currency speculation, they'll make money somewhere. You don't need to worry about that. The cream will rise to the top. But the global economy, ordinary people in that patronising phrase, ordinary people, I always like that. I'm extraordinary, everybody else is ordinary. Ordinary people will be a lot better off as a result. And surely isn't that what public policy is about? And isn't that, if we're going to debate a new Bretton Woods system, remember, why did the Bretton Woods system break down? Well, lots of reasons. One of them was trade imbalances. The American deficit by the early 70s was way out of alignment with the surpluses in Japan and Germany, and the fixed exchange rate system couldn't hold. Keynes had told the Americans that that's what would happen. But the Americans wanted the Pax Americana. They wanted the dollar, not Bancor, to be the international currency. So, I've done this before. 51 minutes, is that all right? I offer this as a talk. We can talk about theory, we can talk about policy, we can talk about political economy, or we could talk about everything. Is that all right, Mark?
Thank you.